Throughout human history, there has been a recurring idea, and that's that the end of the world is right around the corner. This belief that the current generation will most likely be the last generation occurs across time and across cultures. In my own lifetime, I've been witness to at least two full-on apocalypse panics. And I'm only 32 years old. As 1999 became the year 2000, some people panicked that the fabled Y2K bug would lead to a complete civilizational collapse. Airplanes would fall from the sky, financial markets would tank, and bank accounts worldwide would suddenly read zero. When the clock struck 12 and the disaster was nowhere to be seen, everyone was able to giddily dance to Prince and carry on. But not 12 years later, the apocalypse was in the news again. This time, people were stressing about the supposed end of the Mayan long count calendar. What if the ancient Mesoamericans were correct and the world was scheduled to end in 2012? Would the ancient gods of the Mayans return to cleanse the world with fire? Well, luckily for us, they did not. 2012 may have not brought on the same kind of anxiety as Y2K, but it was remarkable that yet again, the end of the world was a topic of conversation. However, perhaps as a student of history, I shouldn't have been surprised by that. The belief that we're living in the end times is so common throughout history that there's actually a word that describes the study of apocalyptic expectations. It's known as eschatology. If you've ever stuck your nose into this obscure corner of study, then you might know that the belief that the end is nigh tends to ebb and flow throughout history. Sometimes the belief that the apocalypse is upon us is relegated to a small group of fringe mystics. Other times, societies can be motivated to do remarkable and terrifying things out of a belief that the world is ending and ending soon. If there's one time and place that was particularly susceptible to this belief, it was medieval Europe. Since the beginning of Christianity, belief in the second coming of the Savior and the last judgment of all human souls had been a key part of the religion. In the early days, it was believed that Jesus Christ was not going to be returning at some distant date. He was coming back soon, so y'all better get ready. But in medieval society, the more canonical version of the end of the world found in the Bible and endorsed by the church was transformed in the popular consciousness by various unsanctioned mystical writings, fiery preaching, and straight-up folklore. For medieval people, the end of the world was even more elaborate than what had been described in the Book of Revelation. There was a popular belief that before the Second Coming, a great figure would emerge on the world stage. This figure would unite the many nations of the earth under one banner. All pagans, infidels, and non-believers would finally convert to Christianity, and justice would finally reign. This figure went by many names. He was sometimes called the Emperor of the Last Days, or the Last Roman Emperor. However, this so-called Emperor of the Last Days was also a doomed figure. It was believed that after the last emperor established his holy kingdom, this would bring about the emergence of the Antichrist. The Antichrist would ultimately betray and kill the last emperor and would then preside over his perverted kingdom until the glorious second coming of the Savior. Upon his return, the Savior would destroy the Antichrist and would prepare the world for the last judgment, when the righteous would finally join God in paradise. Now, to modern folks, this whole process can sound somewhat terrifying. the end of the world is not really something that most of us look forward to. That's to say nothing of a period of tyranny under the quote-unquote Antichrist. However, for medieval people, the end of the world was not a bad thing. In fact, it was a wonderful thing. The only way that earthly suffering could finally come to an end was if the second coming occurred. And there could be no second coming without an Antichrist. And in many of their minds, there could be no Antichrist without an Emperor of the Last Days. This apocalyptic expectation and the legend of the Last Emperor might help to explain why in 1095, crusading fever gripped Europe. In that year, Pope Urban II famously made a speech at the Council of Clermont that ostensibly launched the First Crusade. Now, what the Pope actually said in his speech is pretty hotly contested. But if we believe the most dramatic sources, the Pope made an unambiguous call for a holy war against the Seljuk Turks and any other Muslim powers in the Holy Land. Furthermore, anyone who embarked on this righteous undertaking would be given a complete remission of sin. That's right. If you traveled east to make war, all of your sins would be immediately forgiven, and you could expect a clear path to heaven. Now, whether or not the Pope actually guaranteed a complete remission of sins and specifically called for the total liberation of the Holy Land is a topic of serious scholarly debate. In fact, there is good reason to believe that the Pope never intended for the First Crusade to become the unruly force that it eventually did. But whatever Urban II's true intentions may have been, there's no way he could have predicted the overwhelming response from the people of Europe. Tens of thousands of people from all social classes heeded the call for holy war. One explanation for this wild enthusiasm was the belief that this might just be the beginning of the end. Perhaps if a Christian ruler could retake the holy city of Jerusalem, he might just become the fabled Emperor of the Last Days. This could start a chain reaction of events that would eventually lead to the Second Coming and the Last Judgment itself. This pilgrimage, nay, crusade, was about more than helping Christians in the East. This just might be about the end of the world. You see, when it comes to the event that would eventually become known as the First Crusade, history and myth bleed together in often dizzying ways. The story of how Europeans managed to successfully invade the Holy Land and capture the cities of Nicaea, Antioch, and eventually Jerusalem itself is one of the most surprising in world history. The tale is filled with visions, miracles, and magical objects. In other words, the bread and butter of our fake history. But perhaps more importantly, the Crusades were complicated and messy affairs that aren't easily explained or boiled down. This means that misconceptions, oversimplifications, and straight-up lies often find their way into the popular understanding of this event. When it comes to the First Crusade, myths of all types lurk around every corner. Is it even possible to know the truth about this complex event? Let's find out today on Our Fake History. Episode number 58, How Do You Explain the First Crusade, Part 1. Hello and welcome to Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major, and this is the podcast that explores historical myths and tries to determine what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. We are back from our brief hiatus, and we are ready to take on one of the more challenging topics that we have ever tackled here on Our Fake History. That is, of course, the endlessly complex mishmash of violence, faith, and medieval geopolitics that we call the First Crusade. Now, if you're a particularly perceptive listener, and come on, if you're listening to this show, then obviously you are, then you may have noticed that the Crusades have been in the background of many of this season's episodes. Robin Hood was often portrayed as a returned crusader. Richard the Lionheart was one of the key leaders of the Third Crusade and was arguably one of the Crusade's most successful European generals. In our most recent episode, we explored how the myth of Prester John was able to gain traction as the result of Europeans' paranoia about losing their grasp on the Holy Land. In all of these episodes, I casually dropped references to the Second and Third Crusades, like everyone out there knew exactly what I was talking about. Perhaps that was a little cavalier, but I think it's probably safe to say that if there is any group of medieval events that most people have heard of, it's probably the Crusades. Where so much of medieval history is completely obscure to everyone except scholars and enthusiasts, far more people have at least a passing understanding of the Crusades. This is largely because the Crusades have never really left the public conversation. It's not uncommon for politicians, activists, and campaigners of all descriptions to invoke the memory of the Crusades. In common parlance, we often call anyone who seems to be on a mission a crusader. As a result, the term crusade can have wildly different meanings and connotations depending on the context in which it's being used. For instance, when Dwight Eisenhower titled his memoir about World War II, "The Crusade in Europe," he was obviously using the term to mean something righteous, good, and worthwhile. However, the term crusades is also invoked to describe things that are disastrous, hateful, and deeply misguided. I honestly can't think of a medieval event that is still as politically loaded today as the Crusades. Let me put it this way. It's hard to find someone with big opinions about who really should have won the Hundred Years' War. But the Crusades, on the other hand, a quick Google and you'll find some pretty heated and sometimes hateful debates about whether or not they were a good thing or a bad thing. But this is, of course, because some of the thorniest geopolitical issues of our own times can seem like they have parallels in the Crusades. Ongoing war and strife in the Middle East, violence motivated by religious extremism, and Western military intervention in the Muslim world can all be easily connected to the Crusades. This is to say nothing of the continued conflict over the status over the holy city of Jerusalem, a conflict that has only grown more acute over the past few months. Indeed, since 9/11, it has become considerably more common for politicians to invoke the Crusades when discussing the Muslim world. Famously, in the days after the attack on the World Trade Center, President George W. Bush gave a speech where he said, quote, "This crusade, this war on terrorism, is going to take a while," end quote. A few weeks later, another U.S. president, this time Bill Clinton, also referenced the Crusades when addressing an audience at Georgetown University. In this speech, Clinton spoke of the First Crusade, and in particular the 1099 capture of Jerusalem, as a foolhardy and needlessly bloody undertaking. He claimed that the story of thousands of Muslim civilians being butchered by the Crusaders during the capture of the city was still being told in the Middle East today, and that the West was, quote, still paying for it. In the course of just a few weeks, more than one U.S. president invoked the Crusades in two very different ways. You see, on the surface, the Crusades can seem like an easy historical reference point anytime we're discussing a conflict between the West and the Muslim world. As a result, contemporary political opinions about relations between Muslims, Christians, and/or secular Westerners often color the way the Crusades are remembered. It should perhaps then come as no surprise that the history of the Crusades tends to be a favorite of extremists of all different varieties. In Europe and North America, white nationalists and other anti-Muslim hate groups often adopt Crusader imagery and use the history of the Crusades in their propaganda. Armored knights and Crusader crosses are common symbols used by these groups. If you do a cursory internet search for myths about the Crusades, and believe me, I'm the kind of person that does those kind of internet searches, you run into quite a lot of material that's being put out by the far right. These quote-unquote myth-busting articles are often written from the perspective that the Crusades were justifiable and honorable, and that any source that tells you any different is shilling some sort of liberal pseudo-history. So, if you're doing your own research into this topic, beware of those sites. However, it's also worth noting that the history of the Crusades is also used in the propaganda of violent terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda. Osama bin Laden often referenced the Crusades in his various manifestos. Indeed, he referred to all Western powers with a presence in the Middle East as quote-unquote Crusaders. When railing against Israel, he often referred to a, quote, Zionist Crusader alliance. I bring up both of these examples just to illustrate how the memory of the Crusades has been weaponized by extremists as a way of justifying violence and hate. If you're someone who believes that Christians and Muslims, or more broadly, Westerners and Muslims, are somehow natural enemies, then a cursory and uncritical look at the Crusades might help you reinforce that misguided belief. So perhaps the biggest myth that needs to be busted is that the Crusades somehow prove that Muslims and Westerners are destined to always be at each other's throats. I believe that if we take a close look at the First Crusade, we will discover a far more complicated and nuanced situation than the extremists would have us believe. Now, along the path to coming to a deeper understanding of this complicated event, we are going to bump into all sorts of odd legends and miraculous occurrences. So while we grapple with the bigger questions about the legacy of the Crusades, we can also have some fun with the smaller myths that come bundled up in the story. Now, I've been tossing around the term Crusades rather loosely here, so I should clarify. When we refer to the Crusades in one fell swoop, it can give the impression that it was one monolithic event. This couldn't be further from the truth. In actual fact, there were well over a dozen distinct military campaigns, most of which were completely disconnected from each other, that often get lumped together under the label the Crusades. From 1095 to 1272 AD, there were 9 separate military campaigns that make up what are commonly considered the official Crusades, usually because they had the blessing of a pope. However, there were also a handful of other military actions in those years and beyond, some of which didn't even involve the Holy Land, that can also sometimes be called Crusades. Each Crusade had its own distinct goals, motivations, and success criteria. Now, I certainly do not plan to get into the history of all of these campaigns in this humble series. Instead, I want to focus on the beginning, the First Crusade. And there are two main reasons why. Firstly, the First Crusade is probably the richest when it comes to historical myths. There are some pretty weird stories connected to the First Crusade. And secondly, if you're going to tell a story, it only makes sense to start at the beginning. All future crusades would look to the campaign launched in 1095 as their model and spiritual predecessor. So, if we can understand the First Crusade, then perhaps we can understand something about crusading in general. This is clearly going to be no small feat. So, ladies and gentlemen, prepare yourselves for yet another Our Fake History trilogy of episodes. In today's episode, I am just going to be laying pipe. I need to give you a whole lot of background so you can understand why the First Crusade happened at all. In our second episode, we'll then dive deeper into the so-called People's Crusade. And in our final episode, we'll wrap it all up by looking at the capture of the Holy Land. So let's start by getting a little bit of background and see if we can understand exactly what led us to 1095. To understand why there was a First Crusade, we first need to understand what was going on between the key players in the region known as the Holy Land. First, there was the Byzantine Empire. Now, the Byzantine Empire wasn't actually called the Byzantine Empire. That was a term that was invented centuries later by historians. Now, the Byzantines called themselves the Roman Empire. This was because they were the Roman Empire. Remember, the Emperor Constantine the Great officially moved the capital from Rome to the strategically significant Greek city of Byzantium in 330 AD. Byzantium became Constantinople, and Constantinople became the new center of the empire. Now, we sometimes think of the fall of the Roman Empire as taking place in the 400s AD. Usually, the deposition of the Emperor Romulus in the year 476 is given as the official date of death. But it's important to remember that this was only the end of the Western Roman Empire. In the East, things continued on as business as usual. The empire may have lost control of Western Europe, but that was nothing compared to the riches and urban sophistication of the East. Roman emperors continued to rule in Constantinople for nearly 1,000 years after the fall of the Western Empire. So, why do we call it the Byzantine Empire and not just the Roman Empire? Well, historians use this distinction because over time, the Eastern Roman Empire evolved into something quite different from the Roman Empire of classical antiquity. Unlike the Latin-speaking polytheistic Romans of Caesar's day, the Byzantines were Christian and now used Greek as the official language of the empire. These cultural, religious, and linguistic changes were enough for historians to give the Eastern Romans a brand new name. Now, I'm going to embrace that name for clarity's sake in this series. But just remember, to the Byzantines themselves, they were always just the Romans. Now, for centuries, the so-called Holy Land was just another Byzantine province. The city of Jerusalem and the holiest sites in the Christian world were controlled by the world's largest Christian power. This was, of course, until the rise of Islam in the early 7th century. In a remarkable 10-year period between 622 and 632, the founder of Islam, the Prophet Muhammad, went from being an obscure merchant to converting the entire Arab peninsula to a new religion and bringing the formerly fractious Arab tribes together in a united polity. After his death in 632, his successors, the combined religious and political leaders known as caliphs, undertook a series of conquests that would completely change the world. Just as the Arab armies were gathering steam, their most powerful neighbors, the Byzantines and the Sassanid Persians, were especially weak, having just exhausted themselves in a protracted war. The result was a swift series of Arab conquests that completely destroyed the Persians and hugely diminished the holdings of the Byzantines. By 661, the Islamic Caliphate controlled all of Syria, Egypt, and Persia. By 750, the Caliphate would stretch as far west as Portugal, as far north as the Pyrenees Mountains, and as far east as the borders of India and China. Jerusalem itself was first captured by Arab forces in 637 after a protracted siege. However, it's worth mentioning that the surrender of the city was surprisingly bloodless. Knowing that he couldn't count on any help from the thoroughly defeated Byzantine army, the Christian patriarch of the city, a man named Sophronius, did his best to orchestrate a peaceful handover to the caliphate. He promised to peacefully hand over the city so long as the caliph himself came to Jerusalem and gave him certain assurances about the safety of Christians inside. Sure enough, the caliph Umar came to the city to receive its surrender. This was a pretty big deal. The caliph just didn't show up to every siege that was going on across the empire. Now, not only did Umar agree to spare the Christian population the sword, he also agreed to preserve Christian holy sites like the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Even more significantly, he would not force the Christian inhabitants of Jerusalem to convert to Islam. They were able to continue practicing their religion so long as they paid a special tax known as the jizya. As far as medieval sieges go, that's basically the best deal you're ever going to get. After the Muslim capture of the city, Jews were also allowed to return to Jerusalem and were also allowed to practice the religion if they too paid the jizya. Now, all of this is significant to our story for a few reasons. Firstly, it's notable that in 1095, when the First Crusade was launched, Jerusalem and the Holy Land had been solidly in Muslim hands for well over 400 years. Secondly, it's also notable that for most of the time that Jerusalem was under the control of Muslims, Christians were able to freely worship in the city, and Christian holy places were largely preserved. There's this common misconception that the capture of Jerusalem led to the immediate persecution of Christians and the destruction of holy places, and that this must have been what sparked the crusade. But this couldn't have been further from the truth. Muslims controlled the Holy Land for hundreds of years before there was any impetus in the West to start a crusade. But that is definitely not to say that after Jerusalem was captured by the Caliphate, it was nothing but peace and harmony in the Holy Land. Over the next four centuries, the Islamic world would fracture into warring factions, and Jerusalem would trade hands a number of times. Not every governor would prove to be as tolerant as the Caliph Umar had been. In the year 1009, a ruler known as Al-Hakim bin Amir Allah started a vicious campaign of persecution against Christians living in his empire. His reign was marked by forced conversions and notably the near complete destruction of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. But as experts like Professor Philip Daileter has pointed out, these periods of persecution tended to be the exception, not the rule, in the Muslim world. Indeed, after the death of Al-Hakim, his successors cut a deal with the Byzantines to have the church rebuilt and to end the persecutions. For the most part, Christians were tolerated. They were certainly treated as second-class citizens in Muslim-dominated territory, but on a whole, they were allowed to carry on worshiping so long as they paid the jizya tax. So, what changed in 1095 that would inspire thousands of Christians to embark on a holy war? For well over 400 years, both the Byzantine Empire and the Christians in Western Europe had accepted that Jerusalem was a Muslim-controlled territory. And for the most part, this hadn't even disrupted pilgrimages. However, by the 1090s, the Islamic world was not what it had been some 400 years earlier. What had once been an expansive united empire under a dynasty known as the Umayyad Caliphate had fractured. As many of you know, within Islam, there are two main doctrinal sects, the Sunnis and the Shia. Now, without getting lost in the minutiae here, the main difference between these two groups has to do with who they believe to be the rightful successor to Muhammad himself. The Sunnis believe that the original four caliphs were legitimate, whereas the Shias believe that Muhammad's son-in-law Ali had actually been selected by the Prophet to succeed him. Therefore, the descendants of Ali should still be running the caliphate. Though this dispute might seem minor to outsiders, at the time, it was enough to split the religion and the empire into competing kingdoms. The Sunni Abbasid Caliphate based itself in Baghdad, and the Shia Fatimid Caliphate was set up in Egypt. On top of that, the Abbasid Caliphate itself was internally disunited, with each local governor operating largely independently. As a result, there were constant power struggles and grabs for territory. As I mentioned earlier, Jerusalem often found itself in the middle of these territorial disputes. But it was the arrival of the Seljuk Turks to the region in the mid-1000s that really shook things up. The Turks had originally been a nomadic horse archer people from the Central Asian steppe. Turkish migration into Asia Minor, the Levant, and Persia eventually gave way to a full-on military invasion. This would completely disrupt the existing balance of power. In the 1050s, the Seljuks had managed to capture all of Persia, and the great Seljuk Empire was founded. Soon, the Turks, who were also Sunni Muslims, had managed to put the Abbasid Caliphate under their control. They also started expanding aggressively into the Fatimid-controlled regions of Palestine and Syria, and the Byzantine territory of Anatolia, or what's today modern Turkey. Now, perhaps the most important immediate cause for the First Crusade has to do with the Byzantine reaction to Turkish expansion. You see, in 1071, the Byzantines lost a crucial battle to the Turks, which led to the capture of the Byzantine emperor himself. And there's actually a pretty wild story about the humiliations the Byzantine emperor had to face after he was presented to the Turkish general. Apparently, the Turkish leader stepped on the emperor's neck and made him kiss his boots. They then had this really weird conversation. We're told that the Turkish leader asked the Byzantine emperor, "What would you do if you had captured me?" To this, the Byzantine emperor responded, "Well, I would probably kill you, or I would parade your body through Constantinople." With that, the Turkish leader said, "Interesting. Well, I'm going to do something even worse to you. I'm going to let you go free and let your own people deal with you." Sure enough, this ended up being a pretty terrible punishment. Once back in Constantinople, the emperor was blinded, disfigured, and eventually banished. This inevitably led to a power vacuum in the Byzantine Empire, which led to a series of coups and counter-coups, until a person who will be very important to our story emerged as the emperor. This was the former general Alexis Komnenos. When Alexis came to power, he essentially inherited an empire that was under siege from all sides. To his south, he had the Turks, who were rapidly gobbling up territory in Anatolia. And to his north, he had trouble from invading armies of Normans who were trying to grab Byzantine territory in the Balkans. And yes, these are the same Normans from the north of France who famously invaded England in 1066. So what was the Emperor Alexis to do? Well, he used the classic Byzantine tactic of hiring everyone and anyone to do his fighting for him. To get rid of the Normans, he paid the Venetians to cut off their supply lines by the sea, Germans to attack them from the rear, and notably, he hired the Turks to fight the Normans on the ground. To solidify his southern border, Alexis also cut a special deal with a Turkish ruler named Suleiman. Alexis would recognize Suleiman's authority in Anatolia so long as he would stop Turkish raids into the last strip of land still controlled by the Byzantines on the coast. To get Alexis's blessing, Suleiman would also have to say that he was ruling on behalf of the Byzantines. Now, I'm sure you're wondering why Suleiman agreed to this. I mean, after all, the Turks had defeated the Byzantines in battle. They had them on the ropes. Why then agree to this strange arrangement where a Turkish leader is ruling in the name of the Byzantines? Well, much like the Abbasid Caliphate before it, the Seljuk Empire was hardly a united thing, and Suleiman himself was constantly fending off threats from other Turks. So this arrangement with the Byzantines actually helped him consolidate power. And also, there was still some cachet involved with being a vassal of the Roman Empire. You see, this arrangement created something called the Sultanate of Rum. Rum was the Turkish word for Rome. So Suleiman was technically the first Sultan of Rome. A pretty cool title. Now, this is important because it helps take some of the air out of the argument that Muslims and Christians were forever at each other's throats in this region. The Byzantine Christians had paid Muslims to fight other Christians. They had made alliances with Muslims. Similarly, Suleiman, the Sultan of Rum, would end up fighting other Muslim powers to honor his alliance with the Byzantines. In other words, the diplomatic situation in the region was complex and messy. It wasn't always just Muslims versus Christians. In fact, quite often, more immediate strategic and political concerns trumped any type of religiously based hatred on either side. For the entirety of his life, Suleiman remained deeply loyal to Alexis Komnenos, and consistently honored the terms of their alliance. However, after his death, Suleiman's successors were decidedly less interested in honoring the former Sultan's agreement with the Byzantines. In the 1090s, Turkish raiding started up again. Byzantine towns and cities were once again being overrun. By 1093, almost all of Anatolia had been captured by the Turks, and the survival of the Byzantine Empire seemed precarious. So once again, Alexis Komnenos reached out for help. This time, however, Alexis looked west. He sent emissaries to Pope Urban II in hopes that the religious leader might help rouse an army of a few thousand men to help him repel the Turks and beat back further incursions. Urban agreed to this. However, neither the Pope nor the Byzantine Emperor had any idea what exactly they were about to summon. The official start of the First Crusade is usually dated to November 27th, 1095. This was when Pope Urban II made his famous sermon at the end of the Council of Clermont in France. We're told that the speech took place outside in a field in front of a crowd of thousands. Now, the actual content of his speech is pretty heavily debated. You see, all of our sources wrote about the speech several years after it actually took place. But one of our more reliable sources, the chronicler Fulcher of Chartres, recorded that the Pope said the following, quote, "Your brethren who live in the East are in urgent need of your help, and you must hasten to give them the aid which has often been promised them. For as the most of you have heard, the Turks and Arabs have attacked them and have conquered the territory of Romania, the Greek Empire, and far west as the shore of the Mediterranean and the Hellespont. They have occupied more and more of the lands of those Christians and have overcome them in seven battles. They have killed and captured many and have destroyed the churches and devastated the empire. If you permit them to continue thus for a while with impurity, the faithful of God will be much more widely attacked by them. On this account, I, or rather the Lord, beseech you as Christ's heralds to publish this everywhere and to persuade all people of whatever rank, foot soldiers and knights, poor and rich, to carry aid promptly to those Christians and to destroy that vile race from the lands of our friends. I say this to those who are present. It's meant also for those who are absent. Moreover, Christ commands it." End quote. So there you go. That's some fiery stuff. According to Fulcher of Chartres, the Pope also sweetened the deal by saying, quote, "All who die by the way, whether by land or by sea, or in battle against the pagans, shall have immediate remission of sins. This I grant them through the power of God with which I am invested." End quote. Another source, one Roger the Monk, tells us that when Urban II had finished his speech, the crowd responded by spontaneously shouting, "Deus levolt," which means, "God wills it." They also started cutting pieces of fabric into crosses and placing them on their shoulders to signify that they were now warriors of Christ. With that, the First Crusade was underway. But we should ask, exactly why was the Pope going out of his way to declare a holy war in support of Alexis Komnenos and the Byzantine Empire? After all, weren't Christians fighting with the Byzantines not but a few years ago? Well, as you might imagine, the Pope had motivations all his own. You see, in 1095, Pope Urban II wasn't the only pope kicking around Europe. You see, this was during one of the many eras when there were rival popes or anti-popes. Urban's rival was a pope named Clement III, and in 1095, Clement was looking way more popish than Urban. Clement had the support of the German Holy Roman Emperor, and he was currently installed in Rome, living in the Pope's official residence. Urban, therefore, was on a bit of a quest for legitimacy. Many experts have suggested that Urban was motivated to help the Byzantine Emperor because he thought that this might repair the great schism that had taken place a few decades earlier between the Eastern and Western churches. The Great Schism had been the culmination of a theological, but mostly political, disagreement between the Pope and the Patriarch of Constantinople. This eventually led to a huge round of mutual excommunications in 1054. The Pope excommunicated the Patriarch excommunicated the Pope, and before you know it, boom, you got a schism. Now, no one fully realized this at the time, but this split would prove to be surprisingly permanent. The two sides would eventually calcify into the Roman Catholic Church in the West and the Eastern Orthodox Church in the East. But in 1095, it still looked like the two sides might one day be reunited. If Pope Urban II could bring the sides together and heal the Great Schism, well, that would really help bolster his case that he was the legitimate Pope. On top of that, the Pope had another problem he had to deal with, and that was a European countryside that was filled with violent and oppressive knights. You see, most of Urban II's speech at Clermont had actually been about something called the Peace and Truce of God. You see, in this era, knights were nothing like the chivalrous figures from Arthurian legend. In fact, if there's one myth that needs to be busted, it's the idea that medieval knights were somehow gallant and noble figures. In fact, the exact opposite was true, especially in the 11th century. In this era, the knights were brutally violent and were terribly oppressive to the local peasantry. So much so that the church was doing everything in their power to actively get them under control. In his lecture series on the Crusades, Professor Philip Dileiter uses this quote from an 11th century chronicler to hammer home just how brutal these knights could be. This is a description of a certain knight known as Thomas of Marl. The chronicler writes, quote, "His thirst for blood was so unprecedented in recent times that those who are themselves thought cruel are milder when slaughtering animals than he is when killing people. For he did not establish his victim's guilt of committing a crime and then dispatch them quickly with a sword. Rather, he butchered them and inflicted nasty tortures." End quote. The chronicler then goes on to describe some of those tortures, which include beatings, disembowelments, and most colorfully, men being hung from their private parts until they die. Now, to be fair, Thomas of Marl was infamous for being particularly cruel, but as Professor Dieleter points out, he was different only in terms of severity and not in kind from other knights. Knights were known to rob, extort, abuse, and rape common people with impunity throughout Europe. In an effort to protect average people from the terror of the knights, the church developed something called the Peace and Truce of God. This was a series of rules that were meant to curb knightly violence. These rules included prohibitions against mugging clerics, robbing churches, and arbitrarily beating peasants, seizing their animals, and burning down their homes. Widows, virgins, and orphans were also to be completely left alone by the knights. It also limited the times that knights could fight. For instance, knights would not be able to fight on Christmas or between Lent and Easter. The church also even tried to forbid fighting from Friday night to Monday morning, hopefully to give victims the weekend off from oppression. Now, I'm sure you're wondering, how the heck do you get these violent dudes who are out there stringing people up by their bits to follow these rules? Well, the most common tactic was for local priests and friars to gather together as many saints' relics as they possibly could, all together in one place. Then they would call a meeting, usually in a field, and get all of the local knights to attend. There, in the presence of these holy relics, the knights were told to swear a sacred oath to abide by the peace and truce of God. Now, did this work? Well, kind of. The belief in the power of saints' relics was very real in medieval Europe. In well-known stories about saints' lives, there were countless tales of dead saints tormenting people who had disrespected their relics. Fear of reprisals from saints usually helped keep the knights in line. At least, for a little while. As you might imagine, as time went on, knights tended to forget their oaths. The peace and truth of God would get broken, and new waves of violence would be unleashed. This would then sometimes lead to fresh sets of relics being located and a fresh set of oaths being sworn. For most of the 11th century, the church did its utmost to try and enforce the peace and truce of God. And if Urban II's speech at Clermont is any indication, in 1095, European knights still needed to be reminded to honor the truce. You see, most of what Urban II spoke about that day in that field in Clermont had to do with the peace and truce of God. The thesis of his speech was basically, we need to get back on track with this initiative. Now, the fact that the call for the First Crusade was located so close to a general discussion of the truce and peace of God in Urban's sermon has led some experts to conclude that the Pope saw the two things as complementary. Perhaps if the knights could have their violent energy directed to a noble cause, in this case, defending Eastern Christians from invasion, then maybe that could help preserve the peace and truce of God. If he could give the knights a mission, make it holy, and throw in the added bonus that any violence done on this mission was completely sin-free, then he might finally be able to make the peace and truce of God work. Now, This is just a theory, as it's hard to know precisely what Urban II's motivations were. However, it's notable that most experts agree that the call for a crusade originally had very little to do with capturing Jerusalem. As enthusiasm for the crusade mounted, eventually Jerusalem became the focus. It was all about reclaiming Jerusalem. But it's important to note that that's not how the crusade started. Experts point out that the Byzantines were trying to secure their borders in Anatolia. Urban II was trying to legitimize himself as Pope by healing the schism between East and West and successfully making the peace and truce of God work. It's highly doubtful that either man thought that Jerusalem could or even should be captured. However, what Urban and Alexis Komnenos would soon discover is that a crusade once summoned has a life and energy all its own. It would not be long after Urban's speech at Clermont that zealous freelancing preachers would start preaching the crusade on their own. These passionate eccentrics would prove remarkably successful. These preachers would radically reshape the goals and the scope of this holy war. If the Byzantine emperor had wanted a few thousand soldiers to help secure his borders, what he would get would be a fiery mob of European peasants, fueled by a belief in their eternal salvation and bent on one thing and one thing only: the complete liberation of the Holy Land. Okay, that's all for this week. Join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will continue our series on the First Crusade. Before we go this week, I want to give some very special shout-outs. So I'd like to give a big shout-out to Chase Kenneth Bergeron, to Brian Belfer, to Justice Garneau, to Christy Glasgow, to Scott Todd, to my buddy Ross Watt, hey man, to Woof McWoof, all right Woof, you rule man, to Gilles Van Oosenen, to Michael Anderson, to Jennifer Ebisemiju Madar, I really hope I got that right, I'm sorry, it's a tricky name, Jennifer Ebisemiju Madar, and Craig Holland. All of you have decided to support the show at $5 or more every month on Patreon. And as you know, that makes you beautiful human beings. Thank you so much for going out of your way to support this podcast. Everyone supporting on Patreon, everyone giving one-time donations, everyone buying the extra episodes, you are really making a difference in my life and are encouraging me to keep putting this podcast out. So thanks again for everything. If you're a listener who wants to become a Patreon subscriber, so you like what you're hearing, you want to hear more of it, you want to support what we're doing at Our Fake History, and you want to get some sweet extras on the side, then you should go to patreon.com/ourfakehistory and take a look at all the different levels of support and see which one works best for you. Or you can go to our website at ourfakehistory.com where you can buy extra episodes or make a one-time donation. Or if you just want to hang out at ourfakehistory.com, go through the archive, take a look at the sources I use, look at all the episode art created by Frank Fiorentino, you can do that too. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with me, you can always send me an email at ourfakehistory@gmail.com, or you can hit me up on Twitter at ourfakehistory, Or you can like the Facebook page and follow along there at facebook.com/ourfakehistory. As always, the music that you heard on the show today comes to us from Dirty Church. You can check out Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. And all the other music that you heard on the show today was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.